Hello.
Hello. Is this Irene?
It is.
It's Maria here. How are you?
Good, good.
A bit early. I just wanted to get on so that I could make sure I...
All right. I'm gonna put you on mute because I want to get the speakers all set up.
Okay.
Okay.
There we are.
Hello.
Hi, Betsy.
How you doing?
Wait a second. I got to adjust my sound. I can't hear you. This is the first time I've done this, if you can believe it.
I can hear you pretty well. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Can you hear us?
I can't hear you. Hold on.
Okay.
Unmute.
You are unmuted.
Am I unmuted?
No, I can hear you, Betsy.
I'm at 100%.
Betsy, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Anybody hear me?
Yes.
Can't hear anybody.
Okay, you can't hear anyone. Can everyone hear me?
I can hear you. Rich can hear you.
Rich can hear you. Okay. Betsy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Excellent. Mike, can you hear me? No. Okay. For those of you who just came in, all right, a few more coming in. For those of you who just joined us, we're waiting probably 2 more minutes and then we'll get started. Thank you for taking the time. Okay, 1 more minute. Okay, let's get started. Hopefully everyone can see the title page, Bringing Climate Solutions Home. Want to welcome everyone for taking the time this afternoon. So we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, where communities around the world have been sharing their ideas and solutions and plans for the future. Many times, so often, just in conversations I have with residents, and I'm sure all of you, it's the same. It's like, what can I do? How can I make a difference? So we thought what we would do is just take some time out today and look at the fact that there are answers all around us and that we can actually change our lives and our community with just some simple solutions. So this afternoon, we're going to present a few of these different solutions and we're going to focus on what speakers are going to be discussing, let me go to the next. Oh my goodness. Why is this not happening? There we go. So tonight's speakers are going to focus things such as pollinators, how we can, their importance, as well as how we can attract more to our gardens, home energy and efficiency, recycling, composting, and urban food gardening. These are just some of the solutions, but we really want to hear from you and your thoughts of other ideas that you may have, interests that you have in either these particular topics or maybe others, because maybe if we can, throughout the course of these next few months, create other sessions just like this that are hyper-focused on a particular solution, then we all gain from something like that. So the bottom line is that you can all make a difference. And if you walk away with just one new idea, then we'll consider this to be a successful session. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Etta Marie Matei, who is the founder of Backyard Bounty. For those of you not aware of Backyard Bounty, we have a lovely depiction of their beautiful work down at the Denison Garden, which is at the south end of Zimmerman Park here in town, just kind of across from Aspen Street and at Maple. And what we tried to do, and I don't want to necessarily steal Marie's thunder, but what we tried to do there is look at a space and for what can be done to resolve certain issues that many of us have with our front yards or backyards. Too much sun, too much shade, poor drainage conditions, or we just want something that's lovely, all with native plant landscaping. So that's going to be our first speaker. Then we'll be talking with Michael Whalen, who is the founder of Live Green, and going to be talking about home energy. Betsy Johnson after that, talking about recycling, Ronnie Joles on composting, and Rich Matheny, urban gardening, which I know right now is a hot topic, certainly throughout the town and throughout the state, most likely. So let's take it away.
Hi everyone, I'm Etta Marie Matei, and I'm wearing my bandana because I am aware, like all of us, that we walk outside and we have to protect ourselves from lots of things that are dangerous in nature. And you know, wearing this bandana helps me protect other people. But one of the things that I want to talk about today is something that has come about because of our overuse of protection and our misunderstanding, and that's the insect apocalypse. Globally, we are seeing an insect decline of 45%. 25% of bumblebee species are at risk of extinction, and for many, many, many bugs are going away. We have, in addition to that, 1.5 billion fewer birds than we had just 40 years ago. So why is that important? It's important because all of us rely on pollinators to pollinate the plants that we use for food, for medicine, for lumber, et cetera. And when we use pesticides, even when they're organic, they wipe out beneficial insects. But we also lose beneficial insects and all of these pollinators when we only plant plants that are not native to this region, because native plants native plants feed very specific insects that then birds need and that we need. So in addition to being really careful about not spraying pesticides, we also have to be very aware that in our gardens, in our home gardens, we will help maintain biodiversity by planting native plants. And we don't have to plant 100% native plants to get a lot of benefits. As long as we have about 70% of the plants in our gardens that are native, we will do our part for protecting habitat for all of these insects and birds that then protect us, that allow us to have the food and diversity that we need to thrive. Irene, I'm ready to go to the next slide.
Okay. Let's go again. My goodness. Sorry about this.
No problem.
Let's try this. There you go.
Great.
Okay.
So I want to talk to you about three things that we can do to help pollinators thrive. The first is to protect their habitats. And that means that instead of cutting back all the plants in our garden in the fall, we let those plants stay up over winter so that cavity nesting bees can live in the stems of hollow plants and birds can eat the seeds of native grasses and flowers. So just a little change in the way that you maintain your garden can actually save a lot of the important pollinators that we need and keep birds well fed. I spoke briefly a second ago about not spraying for mosquitoes because pesticides kill all pollinators. They don't target just mosquitoes. So we want to be doing things to prevent mosquitoes from growing, clearing standing water from our yards, using fans on our porches to protect ourselves, attracting birds and bats that eat mosquitoes to our yards so that we use natural sources to defend against them. And one other little, not a little thing, we've gotten into the habit of thinking that a garden looks pretty when we take away all of the leaves, but there's actually a whole bunch of life that lives underneath those leaves in the winter. So if we can leave a small layer of leaves on our beds in the winter, lots of bees particularly and pollinators will overwinter and thrive in our garden beds. So three things that we can do to protect these pollinators that are declining at an enormous rate. And we hope that everyone can get excited about doing this, just these three things.
Thank you, Etta Marie. All right. Michael.
I just wanted to say that when you started speaking, it reminded me of the latest issue of the National Geographic, which says you'll miss them when they're gone.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And that could be disastrous for the planet.
It's
sorry.
So true. Yeah.
No, that's a great point. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, let's dive in.
Hey. Hello, everyone. I hope you're all doing well. Can't quite see this slide, but that's okay. I know what I'm talking about. The slide that I have up is basically showing all the different areas where you can increase your home energy and efficiency by sealing up air leaks. It's also showing how air comes into your house, in through the basement and up through the house during the winter. And then that cycle reverses in the summer, starting in the attic, coming down to the basement. Right now, and I'm sure a lot of you are aware of this, but Pepco has a really great energy efficiency program, which unfortunately is just, they're not doing it right now because of COVID-19, but once things get back to normal, hopefully soon, the energy audits will start back up and you can have an auditor come in and give you a comprehensive audit of your home, showing you ways to reduce energy use in your home through air sealing and insulation, upgrading HVAC and appliances. The program, once you get this energy audit, the program has about $7,500 per person, per residence, that can be used towards air sealing, insulation, and HVAC upgrades. Another important part of the audit is that it looks at the health and safety of your home. It's making sure that you have enough air changes per hour through what's called a blower door test. And then they also do combustion testing of your HVAC appliances to make sure they're venting properly and they're not backdrafting back into your home. Some of the things that you can do, got all my notes here. Just while you're at home, light bulbs are a huge aspect of the energy efficiency program. Basically changing out all your incandescent light bulbs for LED bulbs. Incandescents use about give off about 95% heat and 5% light. So you can imagine how inefficient those are. Whereas LEDs, which is basically where we're going now, we're getting away from CFLs, compact fluorescent lights. LEDs are, you know, a 11-watt bulb is the equivalent of a 65-watt incandescent. So that's a good measure that you can do right now at home. Smart power strips, which are used to shut down products that are in standby mode and using up, you know, that trickle charge. Those are good. Insulating your hot water pipes with insulation wrap. It's really just 6 feet of hot water, 6 feet of cold water coming from the hot water heater. And then looking at your electric base load. Electric base load is what is the energy that you use and you have the ability to change. You know, turning off lights, turning off your computers and printers and using power strips. Doing less laundry, drying your clothes on a clothesline, things like that save a tremendous amount of energy. And your heating and cooling, what you're setting your heating and cooling at. You know, cooling 76 degrees setting is actually fairly cold for a house in the summer. We keep our house at about 78 during the day, and we turn it down at night because we like it colder at night. But in the winter, you know, it's up to you what's comfortable for you, but 60, you know, maintaining the temperature of your home and not overheating it is really important for saving energy. And then also turning down your hot water heater. You don't have to have it at 165 degrees, the highest setting, which can also scald you. But turn it down to 125 is actually a good one. And that is my 5 minutes, which was perfect timing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I just want to remind all the folks who are participating in this call that there are some questions that have been submitted so thus far. So as the different speakers are talking, please feel free to put it in the chat and we'll make sure to get to them. Thanks, Michael. So our next speaker is Betsy Johnson about recycling.
So it seems like this event is all about us living more lightly on the planet. And living more lightly means using fewer resources, reusing the things that we do have, and recycling the things that we don't need anymore. So I'm gonna talk very briefly about our recycling here in the town of Chevy Chase. We use a private company, minority-owned company in Prince George's County, the Good Company. A lot of people don't know that. G-O-O-D-E, you've probably seen their trucks. And they have just put out a new recycling guide, which we sent to the town via the town crier. If you didn't see it there, it is on the website, and I encourage people to look at it. If you have any questions about recycling, you can also call me. I probably can't answer them all, but I'll try to find the answers for you. And there are a couple of things that are very important to achieve really high prices for recycling materials. And that's what we want to do for our contractor, because that may result in lower prices for the town to do recycling. First of all, no plastic bags. Secondly, it's very important to clean the materials because the people that, you know, the people they sell these materials to do not want to take dirty things. So those two things, if you remember to do, will really help out. And now I want to talk about plastics, because plastic recycling is a bit iffy. One thing I want to inform you about is that the big oil companies are not making as much money as they used to be. Poor babies. But they have a new business plan, which is to encourage, invest in more plastics, plastics made from oil. And I don't know, I think probably everybody on this call would agree with me that that is something that we don't need in this world. It's more plastics. And so I would like to present a few things that you can do to reduce your own use of plastics rather than trying to recycle them. First, you can purchase compostable items now. For your big lawn parties where you don't have enough plates and utensils and stuff, you can use compostable items, which the town is now using for all of its events. These are things that look like plastic, but do not put them in the recycling because they are not plastic. They're made from corn and sugar and things like that. And you can put them in your compost, which John is going to be talking about next. Doing away with bottled water. Water bottles are ubiquitous in the landscape and they are a real problem. So you don't need to use bottled water. What you can do is install under your sink a water filter and have a little faucet on your sink. And fill your reusable water bottle with your own filtered water. You can also use tap water. Our tap water is not terrible. So that's one thing you can do. And you can phase out other plastics. Just Google products without plastics. And you will come up with website after website of places that sell products with no plastics. And I've been trying to, you know, reorganize myself, and I have used shampoo and conditioner and tooth tabs, and they work very, very well. And there are other things that I'm about to order from some of those websites. So those are my suggestions. Thanks.
Thank you, Betsy.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, Ronnie with composting, please.
Yes, and I'm glad I got to follow Betsy. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because composting is another form of recycling, kind of the purest form in some ways. And it is something that is not very hard to do, and it makes a huge difference in the environment and in the greenhouse gases. If you throw things in your garbage that are organic foods, let's say the scraps from your meal or the corn husks or the orange peels, there's a gas, the methane gas is released in the landfill, and it is a very bad gas. It's adding to the greenhouse effect a lot. And composting, although it takes a little time to get used to, is something that is relatively easy and it makes a huge difference. And all it really entails is a container. You'll get a container every week, a bucket. I keep mine outside the kitchen door, and I have a little plastic container I keep by the sink. And it's not so little, it's kind of middle size. And in the course of cooking dinner, so many things get put in there. The peel from the onion, just everything. It seems like at the end of every dinner, I have that filled up. And if you ever use paper plates, let's say you don't want to use china tonight, you use paper plates. If you use chinette, and I think other paper plates that don't have the wax on them are best, you can compost them. So you're not really throwing away anything if you used anything compostable. And then every week you put it outside on the curb. You've probably seen the buckets out there on usually Tuesday mornings is at least when our part of the neighborhood is picked up. and they come pick it up and take the bag, and then you have a clean compost bucket and you fill it up the next week. And I have found my garbage, the amount of garbage I make is a quarter of what it used to be. And it doesn't really make sense, because you wouldn't think a bucket of compost would make so much garbage, but for whatever reason, it cuts down enormously on your garbage and on land, what we're putting in landfills if you compost. And somebody, I think you had mentioned, Irene, someone was asking about smelling or odors of composting. Did you send that to me? Should I address that now or just?
That sometimes comes up as a question, but it's up to you as to whether you want to address that now or later on.
I don't really think it's an issue. If I don't put the top on the bucket completely outside, yes, animals will smell it. So you just have to make sure you've screwed the top on. But I find my garbage will still smell more than my compost container, because if you've had chicken, let's say you have raw chicken, what it came in, you can't compost that. It goes in the garbage and that will smell. Or if you have fish, if it was wrapped in something that isn't compostable, that goes in the garbage and that will smell much more than anything in the compost. I do tend to empty it every night or every other night if it isn't full. So I haven't had any issues with smell from the composting.
Thank you. Thanks, Ronnie.
Welcome.
All right. So Rich, I think you're unmuted, but I'm not sure because there's two of you on the list here.
Yeah, I think so. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks, Irene. And it's great to follow Ronnie because I'm a huge proponent of composting as well. So I'm going to talk about, gardening and specifically about raised beds. I garden in raised beds. I'm a huge proponent of raised beds. And I guess the first question people might ask is, what's the point of a raised bed? And there are a number of advantages that I would point out. One is that, you know, you can really control what goes into the bed, what your soil, you know, your soil composition, to make sure it's appropriate for what you're going to grow in the raised bed. It's a very organized form of gardening. It's good as you get a little bit older because it brings the soil closer to you. So you can see in the picture there, I can kind of sit on the side of the raised bed as I'm tending to the plants in the bed. It's also very important because, you know, you don't want to be stepping on the soil that you're growing your plants in. You want that soil to be light and airy and make it easy for the plants to take up nutrients. And with a raised bed, that's very easy to achieve. You can see in this picture, the raised bed makes it very easy for you to put hoops. And those are really just PVC hoops that you can purchase, just lengths of PVC that go down into either rebar or garden stakes on the side of the hoops. Over the hoops, you can put netting to keep birds and squirrels out. It's taken me about 5 or 6 years to figure out how to keep squirrels out of the raised beds. I think, knock on wood, I finally achieve that. I'd have to have you come to my house and take a look, and I'll be happy to show you how I think I've been able to do that. In the winter, I'll probably be the only one on this panel that will be a proponent of using plastic, because I found that when I cover my raised beds with plastic, I can actually overwinter crops that I plant. Like right now, we're eating from the garden mustard greens and chard and lettuce and spinach and bok choy, much of which I planted in August or September of last year. By putting plastic over the raised bed, you create a greenhouse effect and you buffer some of those extreme temperature fluctuations. I just got a comment up there about not using pressure treated wood. I disagree with that comment, actually. My raised beds are all pressure treated pine. You can use cedar. To build one of these raised beds out of cedar would probably cost about $300 to $400. So it's quite expensive. It used to be that pressure treated wood was treated with arsenic, and that was dangerous to health. Now they use copper azole, and my research indicates that it's not a problem at all. If you're concerned about that, you can line the bed with plastic to prevent ingress. But with copper azole, it's going to kill your plants before it's going to get into your body. And so I'm really a big fan of pressure treated, because it's inexpensive. It lasts a long time, and it just works well for me. But of course, everybody has to make their own decision. So how do you make it? People come by and they look at the raised beds and they say, oh my God, that's incredible. How did you do that? It's really just a box, right? It's a simple frame. Everybody's familiar with a box. There's very few rules. One of the rules that I would say is that it should not be wider than 4 feet. You could build a box that's 5 or 6 feet wide, but then how are you going to tend the plants that are growing in the middle of the box? That becomes very difficult to do. Sorry, I'm getting lost on that. So 4 feet wide, it can be as high as you want it to be, but as you make it higher, it gets more and more expensive to fill it with soil. I compost on site and replenish the bed with the compost that I make. So I'm constantly putting organic materials into it. What else can I tell you? I guess siting, you know, ideally you want to have 6+ hours of sun, and that's particularly important if you're growing things like tomatoes or things that produce fruits. And ideally you'd want 8 hours or more, but that's not really critical. And as I've gotten to be a little bit older as a gardener, a little bit more experienced, I've really enjoyed growing those shoulder season things like the greens that you see that are listed there. And you really can grow those things quite well with a minimal amount of sun. Looks like I'm running out of time. The last thing I'll say is try to figure out where you do have the most sun on your property. You might be surprised. It's not always where you think it is. For instance, I have southern exposure in my front, but I actually get really good morning and evening sun on the north side of my house, which you wouldn't expect. There is, it's free, called Lumos, L-U-M-O-S. And it's pretty cool. You can hold it up and it will show you at any point in the year, at any point in the day, where exactly where the sun is. And that's a helpful tool to figure out where you're going to site your raised bed. So I'll wrap up there and turn it back over to you, Irene, but happy to answer questions. There's another slide that has some resources.
Right.
And I would identify myself as a resource because I love talking about this. Stop by anytime. I'm out there as much as possible. Someone asked, what's the app again? It's L-U-M-O-S, Lumos, and Lumos. And but anyway, I'm happy to be a resource. Stop by. We can be physically distant, but I can show you directly what I'm talking about.
Thank you very much. So we do have some questions that have come in, and everyone online now, just keep putting it in, or you can, of course, just join the conversation. So Anna Marie, when you were talking, there was a couple questions that came in specifically around like lawn and grasses. So when we're thinking about native plants and the importance of those, does lawn / grass count as native or non-native? And where do dandelions fit in the picture? And someone's drawing, and I'm not sure why. Okay. Oh, wait a second. I think you might be on mute. Okay, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Okay. So turf grass, turf type tall fescue, is the most common type of grass that we use, is not native to this area. It is a great material for walking on. It's tough. It is also a monoculture that does not provide any environmental benefit. It's not particularly deep rooted, so it doesn't do a good job absorbing stormwater, and it does not, especially when you're cutting, it's not going to flower. It's not doing anything for pollinators. So we'd like to recommend that you have everyone, you know, we need some turf in our properties for walking and for gathering spaces, but try to keep that to a minimum. Try to have as much shrub, perennial, native grasses, native sedges that are lower. You can get green space with that. sort of like that pretty green swath that is appealing with native sedges that will offer benefits. Dandelions are edible. They are, and they have flowers, so there's going to be some pollination that happens, but they're not native to this area.
We do have native sedges, of course, within the Denison Garden. So for those of you who may not have had a chance to visit the website, denisongarden.org, which can also be accessed through, I'll put it in this chat thing, actually. You can take a look at the entire, all of the species of plants that are present in the garden are listed by room. So if it's a pollinator room, what are the grasses that were used or plants that were used? Same with the three other rooms there. So take a look there. Another question that we had was addressing composting at home. So Ronnie, can you address that? And what I think Sheila might be referring to is, what if I want to do, forget about providing it to compost crew, but what can I do at home? Which, that's a phenomenal idea. That's a lot of work. But if you can describe that a little bit more, Ronnie. Oh, hold on one second. I had to mute people because there was a lot of background noise, but it helps if I unmute people. So. There we go.
It sounds like you do home composting. Is that correct?
Yes, doing composting at home. Yes.
Yes, and I do not at this point. I just use the service. So would you mind just speaking about how you compost at home?
Are you speaking with Rich? Or?
Yeah, with Rich. I'd
be happy to talk about it. Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you.
We have... and maybe some people have seen it, but we built a 3-bin compost setup, and each of the 3 bins is about 4 feet square. You need about a 4-foot square bin in order to achieve temperatures that are sufficient to kill weed seeds that you would get from the grass. So I've gotten temperatures in that compost bin in excess of 160 degrees, which is pretty hot. I mean, to the touch, it's quite hot. Most of it is, the carbon input is mostly oak leaves, and then it's grass. It's all the food scraps. Just like Ronnie was saying, she has a thing under the sink that she puts things into. I do the same things. You know, everything from eggshells to sourdough discard to vegetable scraps. Just about everything except, animal products. And it does take a little attention. I turn the compost as much as possible. It's a good physical workout. And then I have a screen that I just built with like carpenter cloth. So I put that on a wheelbarrow and I'll screen the compost into the wheelbarrow. And that goes into the bed. I mean, it's a great thing to do. I don't find the odor to be a problem. I have not found rodents to be a problem. I know people have problems with that. That's not been a problem for me. And it produces, as gardeners will say, like black gold. It's the best thing that you can put into your garden. And just to not have that stuff even going off site, you know, it's like keeping everything that you have on site, all of your carbon, all your nutrients and micronutrients and so forth. So I'm a huge proponent of composting.
Thank you, Rich. I think you addressed this next question as well about not having enough sunny areas in one's yard to grow vegetables and herbs. But with that Lumos app, I guess you're identifying where within your land would be the best spot, and then you take it from there?
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, I guess one of the points I want to make is sometimes the sunniest spot is not the place that you think it is. And I've found that. I've been on this property like, I don't know, 11, 12 years, and I'm just finally learning that behind my house actually gets really good morning and evening sun. That's one thing. The other thing is just generally, a lot of the greens that are listed there on my slide, you could grow those with less than 6 hours of sunlight. But just, try it. Give it a try. I guess the other thing that I didn't get to mention is, if you don't want to build a raised bed, I've had really good success growing in bags, you know, these breathable bags that you can pick up and move around. They're actually better than pots for a number of reasons that we don't have time to go into, but you could just try doing that. And then if you're just getting started, it's portable. So if it's not working in one place, you could take it somewhere else. The raised beds are very hard to move, of course.
Great, thank you. And I did, I'll again, everyone will get this, we'll have a link to this, but these were the resources that Rich specifically alluded to during his discussion, and then some additional resources that were provided by our other speakers as well. So with respect, just to keep things going, one of the things I saw in the news, Michael, was that people are extremely interested in getting bidets right now. And I don't know if it's because of the toilet paper shortage. I don't know if people have got a lot of time on their, I'm not entirely sure. So can you specifically from an energy and water saving perspective, is this something that is helpful?
Well, I can't say I'm an expert on bidets. we actually have one, you know, the type that mounts to the top of your toilet. And they are very, very nice. It does take a while to get used to the whole idea and whether, I don't know, you know, we're so set on our toilet paper that there's the ick factor.
If you get it.
I know, it's a little weird, but it actually, the one that we have, my wife got it from a vendor. They gave it to us. It's a very nice one. And it has a heated seat. It has a dryer. It has a cleaning mechanism on it. I mean, it's a really nice one. The only thing that I can think of, though, is that, like, with the freestanding bidets, they don't dry your butt or your privates. And so you still have to use some toilet paper. And I do think that people are, you know, getting into these because of the toilet paper shortage. I absolutely believe that. But the thing is that if you look at, like, Europe, and I'm not including England, because England and the United States got in a TP because of England. So, everywhere else in the world, they use bidets. The Japanese use 75% of households use bidets. And so there's a lot less waste there. As far as water is concerned, the floor mounted bidets don't use a lot of water, but the ones that you mount on your toilet, obviously you're still flushing the toilet. Mm-hmm. So you're not really getting any water savings there. And so anyway, if you don't have a dryer on your bidet, you're going to have to use a little bit of toilet paper.
Yeah, so it ends up being, thank you. Let's see here. So Betsy, they say that the best thing to do for reducing recycling is to not get materials to begin with that you would end up recycling. So can you provide a couple of tips, your best tips for decreasing plastic overall? You talked about, like, going online and looking at, replacing certain, look for items that you won't need to recycle necessarily. But when it comes to paper consumption or other plastic, do you have some other tips for us so that we don't get into this constant cycle of consumption?
Well, one of the things that I do is when I print on my printer, I try not to print most of the stuff I get, but when I do print and I end up not needing to save what I've printed, or I print on the back of those things. So that's one way. Or I use it for scrap paper, which is another way. But I'd like to address the whole toilet paper thing. Sure. Because one of the things that I like to promote is to use toilet paper made from recycled paper. Because, you know, the whole recycle thing is supposed to be a loop so that you're creating things that then get purchased. And if there's not a robust market for something, then that's a problem. So toilet paper from recycled paper, it's not as soft as toilet paper made from trees, but if we want to talk about climate solutions, we do not want to be cutting down trees to wipe our butts, as you so succinctly put it, Michael. And, you know, toilet paper is great. It's, you know, they probably use newsprint and stuff like that to use toilet paper, to make toilet paper. So you don't really see it as much in, well, I don't shop at Giant and Safeway. I shop at Mom's, my organic market. They have seventh generation. I used to buy Marcal, but now it's being sold through Amazon, which I had to switch because I don't buy things through Amazon. But Marcal is great paper. And yeah, so try that too.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Yep.
Etta Marie, question for you, because we did talk a little bit about pesticides, and it's a pretty hot issue right now. There's certainly a group of people who feel that what's paramount is having that lovely curbside appeal. And then there's certainly a group of people who feel concerned for the impact on our health, as well as our children's and pets' health. So do you have tips for someone when they're either speaking with their landscaping company, or they're speaking with their neighbor who might be utilizing these different pesticides, you know, all around, for how they can help care for their gardens and lawns organically, using organic ingredients that helps with the insect population that you were referring to, and keeping that healthier?
So thanks, Irene. I think a good way to answer that question is to think about an analogy between how we take care of ourselves and how we take care of our garden. So, you know, in order to stay healthy, you exercise, you eat well. And in order to keep a garden healthy, you make sure there's good air circulation. So you prune your plants, you pick up, if there's any infection, you clean up after the infection. You follow natural cycles for feeding your plants rather than using fertilizers. And landscapers will really listen to their clients. And if you ask, and if more and more people ask, then I really believe that you'll see landscapers more and more comfortable stepping out of the traditional practices and learning the organic practices, which are just more about good hygiene and good care of plants. And when you're planting native plants, these are plants that don't really require pesticides to do well. So that's another important thing to note.
Thank you. Thank you. And just in terms of the town, I know that there is a pesticide ordinance that the county has passed where for lawn care, the idea of using pesticides for keeping that lawn as the way we would like, that the town council will also need to take a look as to opting in to that ordinance as well, so that it becomes part of our set of rules, if you will. So if you have any opinion about the use of this or non-use of this, it would be great to hear from you about it. But it will be a topic that the town council will be addressing as well. A couple other questions that have come through. So I guess, Rich, you know, question came in, why don't, instead of growing on our own properties, isn't it better for climate as a whole to just support our local farmers markets So, you know, obviously your expertise, you love what you're doing, but we're wondering, just taking it into a little bit of a different account, should we be supporting our local farmers markets more?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me see if I can take it on. And it kind of links up with this myth about the victory garden, right? People are talking about victory gardens like they're going to grow enough food to support themselves. I have on my property 8 raised beds. They average in size about 7 foot by 4 foot, okay? I probably produce roughly 10% of the greens that we eat as a family. So we do get a farm share. So it's not an either or. I don't do this because I think I'm changing the world. I don't suggest that you do it because you think you're gonna change the world. I do it because I absolutely love it. There's nothing I love better than being outside with my hands in the dirt. That's why I do it. So I don't think it's an either or. You can garden. You're never gonna produce enough food for yourself, much less for your family. And in learning that lesson, you will develop a real appreciation for American agriculture and how difficult it is to produce enough food. You'll also develop a real appreciation for your local CSA, because you'll understand right alongside them how a very late rainy spring is going to delay things, as it has, you know, for us today, or how an incredibly dry summer is problematic. So I don't see it as in conflict. I see them as absolutely hand in hand. But you should garden because you love to do it, because it's a lifelong hobby. The things that you will, it's incredible what you pick out of the garden. If I pick, you know, arugula or mustard greens, I could have them in my refrigerator for 3 weeks and they still are crisp and fresh. So you start to realize, you go to the supermarket, you buy something, it's not fresh. It looks fresh, but it's not. It was picked weeks ago. And you just learn all sorts of lessons like that. So you absolutely should support your farm market. I love going to the farm market. These things go hand in hand.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We have some more time for questions if folks want to just dive in. You don't have to necessarily put it in the chat. I see Mary is raising her hand. Go for it. Let me see if you're unmuted. There you go. Go for it.
Okay, thanks so much. Thanks to all of you for your presentations. A couple of comments. Since we were talking about using native species and trying to reduce the amount of additives, pesticides, and fertilizers, I just wanted to expand a bit on Irene's comment about this new pesticide law, the Healthy Turf or Healthy Lawns Act. The Department of Environmental Protection of Montgomery County has a person who is overseeing this whole movement and providing guidance. Her name is Mary Travaglini, and she will be hosting a Q&A session, I believe it's next week, with about 15 people so that she can actually manage the questions. But it will all be with respect to how to implement that law if the town or any other municipality decides to opt in, and what are the organic or non-synthetic alternatives that can help you, you know, have healthy lawns and healthy gardens. So that will be on their website shortly, and I'm going to send that information to Irene, and I'm sure she'll post. I just want you to be aware that that's coming. And also, Mary is available to talk to residents if they're interested in having her come and give a lecture. Secondly, I think it's super important for all of us as sort of one of the things that we can do as communities to lobby our elected representatives about the changes that we want to see. Create the policy environment that's going to facilitate the good practices, that's going to help, you know, nudge our landscape operators towards better practices. There will always be resistance no matter, you know, how much you try. I've tried to talk to my landscapers and, you know, most of the time they just avoid my calls. So I think it's super important that we let our representatives know. And so everyone should not just vote, but call, be in touch with your council representatives, your state representatives, your legislature. And then one final thing on the plastics. I attended by Zoom a really fascinating group of talks on the latest innovations in science on plastics, how the scientific community is trying to address plastics. It's a whole new generation of plastics that's going to be coming online. They're smart plastics. It's just incredible. And you know, we live in a world that cannot avoid plastics entirely. So there has to be a way that we create better plastics that can be that can decompose into their component parts and then be reconstituted during the synthetic process into new plastics, so that you do have this circular economy. And if anyone's interested, it's the National Academy of Sciences website. It was their annual meeting over the weekend, and it's a truly excellent series of lectures. So I'll stop there. Thanks for the chance to.
Thanks, Maria. When is this Mary's conference occurring through Zoom? Is everyone invited? Is it interactive?
No, she only wants a handful of people, and she has sent out emails to a few people who have contacted her in the past. She needs an audience so that she can manage the questions. You know, people ask questions, she can manage them, you know, without having a gazillion people. And then that whole webinar will go on their site. In addition, of course, you should have all received a little card with information about the new pesticide law. And if you go to the website right now, it's really excellent. So, I mean, you don't even need to listen to Mary's talk, but there will be some very specific questions that will be asked of her, and she will respond to them. So,
thank you. I'll definitely pass that along. One thing I also wanted to mention is in this month's Bethesda magazine, which has on the cover Acts of Kindness, how through this crisis, there's lots of wonderful things that people are doing. There's a lovely article called Welcoming Nature, and our own Adam Marie Matei is one of the folks that's been interviewed and is quoted in this article, and it provides some more information and ideas and additional resources to be able to address that part of things. There was one other question that came through about, are there plans to label each individual plant in the Denison Garden on site? Again, in the interest of less is more in terms of the materials, we wanted to kind of have the plants be front and center. What will happen is when the signage is put in place, there will be a QR code placed on each of the signs. What does that mean? You could take your smartphone and anything that has a camera, turn on the camera function, point it towards the QR code, and the associated list of plants that are in that area is going to come up right on your smartphone. So we are, all that's in place right now, but the actual pictures still need to be filled in. So give us just a little bit of time as things bloom so that we can match everything accordingly. But everything else on site in terms of the list is there, so that you can go to your, as well as the list of local nurseries and invasive plants to stay away from and all of that. So I feel like I've plugged that the Denison Garden so much during this hour, but it's a really exciting project. Are there any other last questions? We got about a couple minutes left. Are there any other questions that folks would like? A lot of you are on mute. I can unmute everybody and see if they're unmuted. Okay, and see if anyone has any last questions. Anyone? Okay. Well, as I mentioned in the chat, everyone will be receiving this presentation with all these lovely resources and links to additional information. Please let us know what you think about this. This is the first time we've done this, and we're hoping this will spur interest in other topics, not necessarily always having to do with climate, but just in general. There's many other committees working on different projects. So if this is a type of interaction that works for you, then please just let us know. And I thank the speakers for their time tonight. This has been wonderful. And I hope you all have a wonderful evening. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.